Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. This afternoon at tea time, there was a question about metta meditation, meditation on loving kindness, and it got me thinking. So I thought I would talk a bit tonight about development of loving kindness as a meditation. I think one of the things that's helpful to keep in perspective as we try to use loving kindness as a meditation object or a meditation subject, is that it has a couple or a few purposes which may be say happening at the same time, or one may be focusing on specifically. One of the purposes would be a decreasing of unwholesome mental states, or a decreasing of unskillful mental states of aversion, ill will, negativity, and that conscious cultivation of loving kindness is a helpful way to undermine that any habit of aversion that comes up in the mind. It also has a purpose of helping the mind to become focused and settled, to have the concentration of the mind that is based on loving kindness, is a because of the nature of loving kindness, in terms of it being a positive mental state, a happy mental state, then it lends itself to being a very useful bridge for the mind to unify and settle and to gather in samadhi. So it's a very useful meditation object for that purpose. And so that whenever the mind does settle and unify, then that is an appropriate basis for insight and understanding to arise, because we're starting to see things more clearly. So these are purposes or different direct ways of directing attention, and they're not mutually exclusive, and actually probably complementary and mutually supportive. Because one of the primary encouragements that the Buddha gives to undermine ill will and aversion is loving kindness, and so that takes conscious effort, and certain maybe willful directing of attention, because if we're experiencing ill will and aversion or anger and upset at something, it's pretty rare that the first thing that comes to mind is loving kindness. There's a certain satisfying energy that comes when you get angry and you have a really good rant, whether it's actually you verbalize it externally or just internally. It doesn't mean it's useful, but there's a certain satisfaction there, kind of righteous. Usually that's exactly it. And so there's this righteous sort of indignation or righteous anger. One is obviously right, somebody's obviously wrong, someone gets upset and angry. Unfortunately, it's kind of dysfunctional. So it doesn't really make one happy. Does the opposite. It clouds the mind, upsets the mind. But we tend to have the way that, say, ill will and anger works, it tends to deflect responsibility from ourselves. Right? And, you know, somebody does something, or does something happens, or that person made me so angry. You don't really reflect on that. Sort of, what do you mean they made you angry? Those are two different things. Nobody makes you do anything. You immediately sort of deflect responsibility, because you know you're always going to be in situations where people do things you don't like or you don't want, or circumstances arise, events take place on a social level, and they're not going to be to your liking. But we tend to. The tendency is to sort of, when we don't feel good about it, then we we blame and deflect the blame onto others. And when we get upset, then we say, you know, it's their fault. We don't recognize that, I mean, when we give rise to anger, we are actually complicit. And we need to take responsibility for that. It doesn't mean you have to like everything. But it does mean that we have to own the fact that we're investing energy in aversion, ill will, anger, negativity, and we have to be responsible for reaping the fruits of that, which is usually it doesn't feel good, and it's not a good habit to be supporting. That's kind of like the story of the Buddha being subject to on the receiving end of an abusive rant by a Brahmin who was upset at the Buddha, and then the Buddha listening to him is in the scriptures, it's sort of calling him all sorts of things, which in those days were probably the coarsest language, and then the Buddha listening to it, and Brahman running out of things in his tirade against the Buddha. There's a bit of a break. The Buddha asks him a question of if you go to somebody's house and you offer them food and they don't, you know, are you in your house? And somebody comes to your house and you offer them food and they don't accept it, then who does that food belong to? Well, and Brahma said, of course, it's mine. And then the Buddha sort of said, well, in the same way that you've offered this abuse, you don't accept it, so it's yours. And a very kind of calm way. I'm sure the Buddha recognized that this is abusive talk. Probably wasn't pleasant to hear, but is not going to get involved in a back and forth, or even biting into it. It's not worth picking up and allowing oneself to get upset or angry. So it's important to see that difference, that you know, one can witness or hear or be on the receiving end of things that are negative or unfair or whatever, as one perceives it, and then consider ways to work around that, deal with it skillfully, but to go into the mode of oh, that person made me so angry, or how could such and such be like that? How could the world be like this? That is to get into the into the reactive mode is we're doing that ourselves. And to react out of anger, ill will, is always negative. And isn't a helpful strategy. So then that's why in the Dhammapada, the Buddha saying that hatred is never overcome by hatred. It's only overcome by love alone, metta, loving kindness. And said, this is an eternal law. And that is the the way things actually are. So that recognizing that this cultivation of loving kindness as a means of undermining any habit or conditioning towards ill will is a very fruitful, necessary investment of our energy and attention, so that we can align ourselves with an eternal principle, eternal truth. Also, when we think of the cultivation of loving kindness, one on that sense of undermining ill will, aversion, that's a fruitful directing of attention. But then also, it has the tendency or the propensity to elicit states of well-being within the mind, within the heart. It's that conscious directing of attention to well-wishing. That's because sometimes, just in terms of language, sometimes it's hard to, like, that idealization of I've got to be loving and kind to everybody. But, you know, on a certain level it's true, but it's also, maybe it's not quite that black and white or that strong. But that sense of well-wishing is really important. It's like when we do the Buddha's teaching there's many teachings on loving kindness, but the one of well-known discourse from the Sutta Nipata, the Metta Sutta, there's the phrase, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. It's just that. And that's kind of the essence of the metta citta, the heart of metta. It's that well-wishing, the wishing for all beings to experience happiness, safety, security, well-being, ease. So those are, and when we realize that you know, all beings actually do wish for that. Nobody sort of wakes up in the morning and go to brush your teeth, look in the mirror, and sort of, well, how can I be more miserable today? It isn't part of our makeup. We quite naturally how can I experience more well-being, more happiness? And we may have not so skillful strategies for that, but we do. There is that wish for happiness and well-being. It's quite natural to all beings. But so to make that very conscious helps us to then start seeing both methods for ourselves as well as for recognizing it in others, and then we can be maybe proactive in supporting that wish for ourselves and for others. When it comes to meditation, then it's that cultivation of loving kindness. It does elicit these when we can develop a continuity of wholesome mental states. That in itself there's a settling in the mind, where we're not pulled off in different directions of distraction and irritation or obsession in different ways. But when there's a pleasing object of attention that we can allow the mind to unify with, and that is pleasant to unify with, that the mind will settle. And loving kindness has that potential. It has that inherent within it. It's a pleasant feeling to be with. And so that we're just learning how to elicit that, so that cultivation of loving kindness practice, and there are many different methods and techniques that have been cultivated since the Buddha's time as a meditation practice. And generally, one would direct attention to oneself first, so that trying to establish a sense of ease within oneself, a sense of a bright, wholesome continuity of these thoughts of loving kindness, and as a traditional method and as a general approach, I think it's very useful, necessary, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to work for everybody as well. So that sometimes focusing on the wish for all beings, or directing attention to particular beings who are maybe like a benefactor or a beloved person, teacher, somebody who one respects and feels a sense of trust with, then that object of attention allows the mind to gain some momentum in that feeling of loving kindness, and then one can bring it back to oneself. Because on a certain level, at some point, we have to come back to ourselves to establish that within ourselves. Because we can only share what we have. Otherwise, it's a concept or it's an idea. So that, but we have to be sensitive to, well, what's actually working and how do we make it work? How do we support this process of of loving kindness being established. And sometimes finding a particular method or technique and of course our chanting book has many, like the Metta Suttas in it, the verses on universal well-being are there. The one starts, it starts, may I abide in well-being, freedom from affliction, freedom from hostility. Those are phrases that we can use to help elicit a feeling. In the same way, may all beings, may everyone abide in well-being. And then extending that out. Recognizing, okay, how is that working? How's it feeling? Is it at work? Or the chant on the divine abidings. Where one takes the developing of loving kindness and begin to extend to the different directions. I will abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the fourth. As above and below, around and everywhere. So it's a way of okay, what's working? What resonates? And of course, also as we do it, sometimes we find something that works, and we do it for a while, and it's working. The mind gets used to it, and a certain level it gets inured to it, so. Doesn't quite elicit the same feeling. And then you have to recognize it isn't as if one has failed somehow. This means the human mind is like that. We just can't make things be the same all the time. Mind gets distracted, it gets bored. So then we have to find something else to try to make it. So we have to engage in that process of how does this work? How do we elicit it? How do we prop it up and maintain it? How do we support that? So it becomes an interesting object of reflection. And that in itself is really wholesome. When we, again, where we start, we take responsibility for it. And say, okay, we have this opportunity to direct attention. And I know for myself that I've done various practices. One of the ones that sets of phrases that resonate for me is Bhante Gunaratana. In his teaching, and I'm not sure where he got it for his, because he's quite traditional, but I've never seen it anywhere else. Phrases of may I be well, happy, peaceful. May no harm come to me. May no problems come to me. Dangers come to me. May I always experience spiritual success. May I have the patience, determination, and understanding and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable problems, difficulties, and failures in life. May I meet them, may I always meet them with virtue and integrity, kindness and compassion, mindfulness and wisdom. And these are, I find those phrases very, one, quite practical, and two, quite and somehow resonates with me. And but then also taking that, directing that attention to oneself, but in the same way then starting to extend it out. As we extend that quality out, then it's a way that we can be opening the heart to a more expansive and spacious wish for happiness and well-being for others, for all beings, for particular beings, those who are close to us, family, friends, who are neutral, and even those who we have had issues with, even extending it further to all beings. And it's just allowing that to become more expansive. So paying attention to the development of that feeling of a heart of expansive and spacious well-wishing. We're part of that. So that realize, oh, that will be affecting us. And so it's just like sort of that back and forth of how to create both a supporting of our own well-being, but then allowing that to include all others. And in that including of all others, including ourselves. One of the idioms that's sometimes used for the developing of loving kindness is the ascending of loving kindness out. And what's worked for me more is there's a disjointed feeling of trying sending loving kindness here and there. Just allowing that feeling of loving kindness to be more like a vessel that gets larger and larger and larger and more inclusive. It's more like you can invite beings into this space that you're creating. And of course, we get included in that. As we do that, it tends to elicit, if it feels tiring or or oppressive, then it's important to come back to that feeling of happiness, or that wish for happiness that they're trying to elicit, because we can, again, tire ourselves out by trying to force the mind into some sort of mold. But that cultivation of well-wishing and wishing for happiness, wishing for safety, wishing for security, wishing for peace. That's a very bright mental state. The heart is uplifted by that, and then to allow that to settle and be a bridge of where it can be its own meditation object in the sense of that feeling, or one can be using another meditation, say like the breath, and the breath is a tangible object, but then it's suffused with that feeling of loving kindness, suffused with that feeling of well wishing and happiness, and that sense of well being and well wishing. Is then as easily transformed, or can be used to help elicit the feeling, the experience of abhiti and sukha, which are the joy and happiness, and which are part of the process of the settling of the mind, bringing the mind to a place of unification, sense of ease and joyful energy and settling takes place, and the mind can start to gather and unify. So then that other things start to fall away, different worries, fears, concerns, obsessions, they can start to fall away, and you can take delight in that object of meditation, with the breath, and that object of the metta nimitta. It's like the sign of loving kindness, the feeling of well-being, and that's a helpful tool for allowing the mind to relinquish. To see clearly, it isn't that you're sort of blocking anything out, but the feeling of well-being is more interesting, and the mind can settle. The Buddha actually uses. Even these really bright states and peaceful states, even those can be used for an investigation of insight, where the 'cause even something as when the mind does settle, the mind becomes very refined, very peaceful, very clear, and then it'll change. even at something as bright and delightful as the settled mind with loving kindness as its object, because its evenness is subject to impermanence, evenness is subject to change. Oh. And it's that reflection of an insight reflection on that principle of anicca, of change, and that insights into the universal characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta. Let's say a catalyst for insights. It's not as if one is sort of, oh dear, my meditation's falling apart. It's just mind's always falling apart. That's the nature of the mind. It's our obsession with trying to make it fixed, and as if we're finally going to get it right somehow. Yeah. I mean, there's skillful approaches, and there's skillful ways of dealing with the conditions of our being, and that cultivation of peace and clarity and stability and spaciousness, those are really important. But then it's also important to reflect on their change, their uncertainty. But then we can be turning to relinquishment as well, not holding tightly. And it's one was making really skillful choices, learning how to take our experience and not be overwhelmed by it, not being oppressed by it, not being oppressed by our own mind. So either we have this opportunity to train the mind, to learn and understand the heart, understand this human condition. I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
And mayam dhamma kataya sadhu karam dadama se.